It's musical chair time in the political world, and the music is about to stop. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
You know, I never know what intro you're going to use. We never discussed this up front. That one was interesting.
Okay.
I got to tell you. So an intro is supposed to pique your interest, so you stick around, because I know that this is a little inside baseball for you folks, but it doesn't necessarily sound the same when we record it as it does when you hear it. Things are done to the recording so that it fits in a certain spot, and there are advertisements stuck in between and that kind of stuff.
Chuck modulates my voice so little children don't go running, screaming, and crying as far away from the radio as they can.
It's not quite like that, but the intro comes up, and then you know it goes into ads and that kind of thing. So that it's supposed to pique your interest, so you stick around and listen to the show. Well, that should do the job.
But now you've just ruined it for everybody. But no, actually.
Well, this part comes up after
the
ads.
This comes up after the ads, so that's good. Yeah. That's good. Well, anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be talking today about a number of things that are happening in and around the political world. Surprise, I know we don't ever go here on this program, but we're going to do this today because over the last week or so, we've had some interesting developments that have happened politically. And the biggest development, and part of the reason for the musical chairs intro teaser, is the fact that United States Speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, Republican Congressman from Ohio in Butler County, announced suddenly that he was not only stepping down from the position of Speaker of the House of Representatives for the U.S. Congress, but that he was also, as of the end of the month of October, leaving Congress, retiring, walking away. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this comes as a little bit of a surprise to a lot of people, but to those of us who really have been paying really close attention to what's been going on in Washington, D.C., and yes, I know that's next to impossible to really accomplish, even for folks like me who have a lot of experience doing it, it wasn't really all that big of a shock. Because you see, John Boehner has been under quite a bit of scrutiny and criticism from his own party. And I'm not just talking about the activists out in the hinterlands, and God knows I love each and every one of them. But I'm really talking more about members of his Republican congressional delegation, including a group called the House Freedom Caucus. Now, the House Freedom Caucus is kind of a new entity. It just formed during this session of Congress because during the last leadership elections, a lot of promises were made that weren't fulfilled. And therein lies one of the reasons why John Boehner was having some problems in his own caucus. Now, the House Freedom Caucus, some folks might recognize a name or two in that caucus. It includes Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan from Urbana. As a matter of fact, he was one of the founders of the caucus. And Jordan has never been shy about it, you know, talking about his concerns and criticisms over John Boehner's leadership, especially his supposed conservative credentials. Well, it all came to a head, Chuck, here in the last couple, 3 weeks, as it became very apparent that John Boehner was willing to compromise completely with the Obama administration in order to avoid a quote-unquote government shutdown, which you and I both know, and we've explained on this program before,
it's a misnomer,
is a complete misnomer, because, number one, you actually have to be following the Constitution to govern. Little side note there. But government never actually shuts down. What happens is they delay payments, or they furlough some people for a short amount of time,
right,
until they put enough pressure on congressmen to vote for the package they want, which is expansive spending. And then they bring everybody back, pay them all their back pay, plus bonuses.
Plus a bonus, yeah.
Plus bonuses, and promise them that, you know, that they'll get all these goodies in the future. So that's what happened the last time the government supposedly shut down.
Two times.
So, matter of fact, I kind of agree with the moderates in Congress that we have to avoid a government shutdown at all costs, because number one, we never do it right. And number two, it always costs us more money because they have this bleeding heart syndrome of going back and paying everybody that they furloughed. In all honesty, Chuck, I think we need to have a government slim down. That's where you start cutting agencies and bureaucracy right. and personnel and get rid of redundancies and get rid of, well, oh, perish the thought, unconstitutional or non-constitutionally authorized branches of the government and agencies of the government and
right.
appendages of the government. And, you know, just like bad appendices, you cut them out and you get rid of them. You're never going to hear that out of Congress unless you get someone in there like a Ted Cruz or a Rand Paul or someone.
Or Jim Jordan.
Or, well, yeah, to yeah, that's,
I mean,
I'm not knocking Jim Jordan at all, but he has not been the poster
right.
child.
He's drunk a little bit from the Potomac, as they say.
For constitutionalism.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he's not a constitutionalist, so don't get me wrong. I like Jim. I've known him ever since he was a freshman rep in the Ohio House of Representatives. He came in the same year as my original boss, which was 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And he's always been a fairly good vote for conservative pro-life, pro-family issues. So I'm not going to give Jim a hard time on this. But the key is that they finally had enough of a core group in this Freedom Caucus of about 50 to 55 members who had promised amongst themselves that they were not going to ever again support John Boehner for Speaker. Now, Chuck, you know, we may sit there and think, well, that's great, but, you know, Speaker election only comes up after a general election every 2 years for the next year. So, you know, oh, they can make those promises now, but hey, you know, that's going to happen in November and December of 2016. We'll see what happens then. Ah, but then another piece of the puzzle fell into place when a resolution was brought over the summer by one of the members of the Freedom Caucus. I believe his name is Patrick McHenry, which I think is great, you know, Patrick Henry. Patrick McHenry from North Carolina brought a resolution that was a motion to vacate the chair. That means it's a vote of no confidence on Speaker Boehner. Now, McHenry brings it up, and of course it gets heavily derided by the establishment and the K Street lobbyists yep. and everybody else whose part and parcel bread and butter is making sure the machine runs the way it always ran. But then they started noticing that in order for Speaker Boehner to survive a vote of this nature, he would have to reach out and basically promise Nancy Pelosi anything and everything she wanted because they didn't have enough votes in the House in the Republican caucus because yeah. the Freedom Caucus was going to withhold their votes. That's when it became a actual play. You know, first it's a promise, then it's an actual play. And now we're going to start seeing Act Two of the play that's going to happen. Actually, it will have happened by the time this airs on Saturday, because in announcing his retirement and stepping down, Boehner also set a vote for the new House Speaker to be appointed. And that vote is supposed to happen on Thursday, October the 8th, when we're taping this on Tuesday beforehand, and it'll play on Saturday after. And right now, that vote is still going to be held on Tuesday to name the new speaker. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that whole speaker race. But what it gets right down to is that announcement then opened Act Two. And Act Two saw the presumptive replacement, Representative Kevin McCarthy from California. Who is second in line behind John Boehner in the House current House leadership. And McCarthy looks to be the, you know, heir apparent, the shoe-in, the establishment choice, the K Street lobbyists all love him, that kind of thing. But then Kevin McCarthy said something that basically threw the entire Republican caucus into an uproar.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. He was asked a question about whether he was conservative enough to get the support of enough people in the Republican caucus to get elected. And he said, look what we did. We formed a committee on Benghazi, and look what it's done to Hillary's poll numbers.
Exactly. He basically, in other words, he gave them an
electoral lever and a club.
So, in other words, what Kevin McCarthy actually implied by that statement, and it's being taken as such, is that you had a body of the federal government, the House of Representatives, who formed a committee solely for the purpose of impacting a presidential election in a negative way for the presumptive Democratic nominee. In other words, violating as many federal laws as you could possibly hope to imagine, and we won't go into all of them today, but McCarthy basically intimated that this actually was a committee that was only formed really to kill Hillary's chances to run for president.
Which is an absurdity if you think about it.
And it's a disservice to the ambassador and the three men who gave their lives in Benghazi.
Yeah. It's laughable, Barry, that this is... Kevin McCarthy was so desperate to get conservative votes. And it also shows, by the way, the mindset of the GOP establishment, how they think that the conservative wing thinks.
Right, that it's all about Hillary all the time, and as long as we say we're doing something to get Hillary, then they'll go along with anything.
It's very expository of what they think about how conservatives think. This is why, basically, the GOP establishment is nothing like conservative. Let's get this out of the way. Now, there's an article I just ran into, and I sent you a copy of it, and you can look at it at some point. But there's an article I ran into by a guy named Leonard Pitts Jr., who writes at the Miami Herald, and he is anything but a conservative.
No, and Leonard Pitts is an African-American journalist. He's pretty hardcore liberal. He revels in taking swings at conservatives and has for 20 years. I've read stuff from Leonard Pitts going back when I started working in the legislature.
Right, exactly. It's in the Tampa Tribune. I think he writes, though, for the Miami Herald.
Well, in one of the two or both, yes.
Leonard Pitts Jr., with Boehner's takedown, one less adult in a party taken over by crazies. When you start getting backpats and essentially what amount to hagiographies written by a guy named Leonard Pitts, what does that tell you? Now, if Boehner were not in trouble, Leonard Pitts would be all over Boehner as some kind of a screaming conservative.
Absolutely, because it would he's in a captive position because he has to live up to the conservatives, etc.
But what's becoming clear is that Kasich was what Lenin always called essentially Western progressives. He called them useful idiots. And basically what he's saying is that John Boehner was a useful idiot for the liberal caucus, the minority party in Congress.
Well, yeah.
That's exactly what he is admitting, that he would be excoriating him if he hadn't just lost his seat because the conservative caucus just threw him out.
Right.
So we're getting the truth.
Well, absolutely. It's starting to boil out. Even the day that John Boehner actually announced his stepping down, even Harry Reid tweeted out, "Oh, you know, you're losing a common sense voice and someone who understood the art of compromise." In other words, someone we've played as Democrats for ever since he's been Speaker and gotten our way when we lost the majority.
A case of Johnny Walker, and voila, he's in your pocket. That may seem unfair, and it's a little bit of a straw man, and I'm just having a little fun with it. But the idea that John Boehner is somehow capable of sober conservative reflection is just abject nonsense. Does he sit in a conservative district? Yes. And you know how he does what Tip O'Neill always said, politics is local. He knew how to go into the district, glad hand with the right people. There were always people who were screaming, "This man is not a conservative." And basically those people were marginalized. Well, the problem is that particular caucus in the House of Representatives is tired of being marginalized. And we have to go back to Kevin McCarthy, who thought he was going to gain support by completely misconstruing the thoughts of the conservative wing of the party. They're mad because Hillary Clinton abused office.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other part of that is that McCarthy, in opening his mouth that way and making such an asinine statement, actually opened the door that he now has not one, but two challengers for the speakership. One is Representative Daniel Webster from Florida, who was the former Florida Speaker of the House. I've known about Dan Webster for almost 20 years now, too, because actually when it comes right down to it, if people in Ohio think Jim Jordan is a conservative rock star, Dan Webster makes him look like a moderate. I mean, this guy is absolutely...
He's the real McCoy.
110% yeah. The real McCoy. Will he get the support in the caucus to become speaker? Probably not. I'll just be quite frank about it, because that's the trade-off game is not something that Dan Webster plays very well.
K Street won't allow it.
Probably not.
And let's talk about who K Street is just real quick. Again, that's an inside baseball term.
K Street is the street in Washington, D.C., and it's actually named K Street. That if you drive down it, it's lined with multi-million dollar office buildings, all of which house multi-million, if not billion dollar, lobbying firms.
Lobbying firms.
That's the street where the high money lobbyists live, where they operate out of their various law firms and businesses. That is, and it's become the reputation of, if you're successful in Washington, D.C., it's because you have been favored by K Street. And it's also the retirement address of many former leaders in the United States House and the United States Senate. As they leave Congress, they move directly to a K Street firm in order to continue doing exactly what they were doing before, which was influencing everybody to vote a certain way.
Yep.
But they get paid directly for it by the K Street lobbyists.
Rather than indirectly through donations.
Through
to
campaign
the
donations.
The
That's
Republican
right.
National Committee. In fact, a huge amount of the money that goes into Republican National Committee, a lot of the soft money is what they call soft money, again, inside mm-hmm. baseball term, which means indirect. They're not direct to a candidate.
Right, exactly.
Donations.
Or it's expended by a special interest. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later, too,
yeah.
in Ohio,
yeah.
because that's happening now, too, where they form a new entity, give it a funny-sounding name, and then dump lots and lots of money from big money donors who have already maxed out their direct contributions to the candidate, because we do have campaign finance issues and limits yeah. both at the state and the federal levels, where an individual can only donate up to so much money per cycle to a candidate before they're prohibited by law from giving to them. But they're never prohibited from taking that excess money and dumping it into what's known as a 527 or a PAC or one of these special interest organizations, which is then utilized to, not directly coordinate, because they never want to do that, because
right.
that would be illegal, but to run ads and interference for particular candidates.
Well, one of the tools that a whip in the House of Representatives, or the what's the equivalent in the Senate? It's not a whip. It's something else. He's the drum beater for the speaker, or in the Senate for the president, the presiding officer, to get the votes that they need.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it's a conservative versus a quote-unquote moderate, which is really a liberal position. Okay, the whip will go around and say, you know, this is a pivotal issue. If you don't get on board, you're not going to get RNC reelection money. And in fact, there's talk of running an establishment candidate against you in the primary, and they will get RNC money.
Yeah, and that goes on all the time. So,
yeah.
It's amazing how often.
What's
that goes
the Senate
on.
Equivalent of? There is an officer, but I can't think of who he is.
Well, usually, because you've got the Senate majority, because of the way the Senate works,
yeah.
that the president of the Senate in the United States Congress is actually the vice president of the United States.
Yeah, well, when I say president, I mean president pro tem.
Yeah, well, you mean the majority leader.
The majority leader.
I've always heard it called the Senate whip. As far as I know, it's still a whip. It's still
yeah.
a whip. Yeah.
Well, that position is ancient. It goes back to Britain, to the parliamentary system,
mm-hmm.
the whip does. And the whip is basically exactly what it sounds like. It's so the speaker or the leader of that particular group can whip his members of his party into shape.
In other words, whip up votes. In other words, it's a vote counter.
Yeah.
He's the guy who goes around and counts noses ahead of time to make sure that they've got the votes and they don't have people jumping off ship. But that's really what it gets right down to. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, it's you've got the The whip is the whip. Now, sometimes they might be called the conference secretary.
Yeah,
that may be what you're thinking of.
But the Senate tends to be a little more genteel.
Mm-hmm.
In outward appearance, underneath it's tooth and claw, just like it is in the House.
Right. Yeah. In the U.S. Senate, the current Senate whip is Senator John Cornyn from Texas.
Oh my gosh. No. Okay. There's one of the problems right there.
Well, and do you realize that there is a president pro tem of the Senate?
Yeah.
Of the United States Senate. Okay. Trivia question.
Uh-oh.
Who is it and why?
I thought the president pro tem was the majority leader, but apparently not.
No, it is not.
It's not.
This is a great constitutional trivia question.
Yeah, it is, because that's an elected office.
Yes.
And I don't know who it is.
Okay. During this Congress, the president pro tem of the United States Senate is Orrin Hatch from Utah.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Because seniority.
Seniority. And the fact that he is of the opposite party from the vice president.
That's right. The president pro tem is always the opposite party from the vice president. Yes.
And the person who has the most seniority in the body in that opposite party.
And you know what? That's a Senate rule. That's not a constitutional rule.
You're right. It's not a constitutional rule, but it is. But in the Constitution, the Senate has the right to set the rules for their chamber.
That's right. They do.
So anyhow, so that's just a little, there's a little constitutional and Senate trivia for you guys. But when we get right down to it, so now we're back to the House side. Kevin McCarthy, but a third individual just stepped in last week. A Congressman Jason Chaffetz. Now, Chaffetz is from Utah, I believe.
Yes.
He's one of the younger guns. I believe he's a member of the Freedom Caucus. And he's a guy who lives in both worlds. Let's put it that way. He's not unliked by K Street, but he's more conservative than most. He's the chairman of the House Government and Oversight Committee, which just recently held the hearings on Cecile Richards and Planned Parenthood. And, of course, Chaffetz, you know, as the chair of the committee, gets to grab the cameras and the microphones and have his way. And he did a pretty good job of beating up on Cecile Richards and Planned Parenthood's fake claims about being for women's health care when none of their 600 locations has a mammogram
machine. Mammogram,
yeah. So he's decided that he's doing some head counting and nose counting of his own. And he realizes that Kevin McCarthy doesn't have the votes he needs in the caucus in order to be the presumptive speaker, and so he's jumping in. Now the question then remains: where is it all going to go? Now originally, the vote called by Speaker Boehner for Thursday the 8th was for the leadership,
all of it, the whip,
But just this morning, before we tape this, Boehner made a counter-announcement to say, no, we're only going to vote on the speaker's position on the 8th, and the rest of the majority leader's position and everybody else's is going to be pushed back to October the 29th.
The day before speakers.
Which is the day before the formal vote for speaker on the floor. Now, supposedly, according to The Hill and other sources in D.C., that he did this postponement of these other positions at the request of the conservative wing of the party. And, Chuck, it would be monumental, because I think this would be the first time Boehner's ever done anything for the conservative wing of the party at their request, in one way, any way or the other. And you know what? I don't necessarily disagree with that, because I think I understand what conservatives may have been thinking about this. McCarthy doesn't have the votes right now, right? Correct?
Exactly.
But there were spots opened for both the House Majority Leader and the House Whip. You have two people running against you, Jason Chaffetz and Daniel Webster. If you're McCarthy and you're a shrewd player, what do you do?
You play them off.
You play off and figure out which, tell them that you're close enough to get the votes, and could you get one of their supports by offering them the majority leader position?
Yep.
Okay. So here's the conservatives, knowing that that's probably where the game was going to be played, asked to have those two separated so they couldn't be used as a lever on Thursday in order for McCarthy and his team to be able to give up a position to the conservatives in order to get the speakership. Okay, I think it's funny. It'll be interesting to see how many votes it's going to take on Thursday in order to get that speakership. But, you know, you and I have talked about this privately off air, and I'll just state it publicly on air. I don't think it matters who wins this vote on Thursday or who gets actually put into the speaker's chair at the end of October, because really all that person's going to be doing is going to be an interim speaker until after the 2016 elections, because that's the only thing they're going to be judged on, Chuck. It's not going to be on how bipartisan or partisan they are. It's not going to be on anything else. It's going to be on how did you help us win seats in Congress. And if you're a conservative, you'd better hope that you win a lot of conservative seats, but you're going to have K Street and the establishment fighting against you, as you talked about earlier.
Absolutely.
And if you're a moderate, it's how many of the Tea Party members did you get knocked off? And to be quite honest with you, the way it works, if Kevin McCarthy wins this vote on Thursday and is made the new speaker, he will not be voted again as Speaker of the House come 2017 should the Republicans keep the majority in Congress, because by and large, I think that there's going to be a strong enough push in enough open seats and in enough swing seats that the conservative caucus is going to strengthen.
Probably.
Because whether the establishment likes it or not, and your comments about McCarthy earlier misunderstanding conservatives is spot on, because so does the establishment and so does K Street, the conservatives are growing up politically.
Yes.
And they're becoming more refined. They're starting to raise money. They are starting to understand how to use the tools that they need to use in order to stop things from happening. And they're winning elections, Chuck. That's the key. They're starting to win elections because they're starting to reject the politics of this is the best we can get.
Right.
And for the 2016 cycle, that's not going to bode well for establishment, middle of the road, moderate, I've been here for life, so elect me again, members of Congress.
Okay. There are places where moderates are, the only thing that's going to get elected is moderates.
Well, yeah.
Peter King on Long Island, New York.
Right. You're not going to get a rock rib conservative out of Long Island.
Let's face it. At any place in New York, except maybe upstate someplace, and I think there are a couple of these guys.
Yeah,
you're not going to get a strict constitutionalist. You're going to get a guy who's basically Democrat Party light. That's why I always laugh when the leftist news media always goes to Peter King when they want a slam of Ted Cruz or any conservative
Republican
or Rand Paul or name a conservative or even Donald Trump.
I thought you said name a conservative.
Well, exactly. Trump isn't a conservative. But what's interesting there is he's been kind of quiet about Trump, and I know why. Because he lives in Trump's backyard, and he may have to go to Donald hat in hand at some point and ask for money. As I recall in the first debate, I'm still laughing about this. Lindsey Graham came out and was excoriating Trump. And Trump said, "Well, you weren't saying that when you were in my office asking me for money, when it looked like you might not get reelected." And you know what? Graham shut up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course he did.
Because Trump knows where a lot of the bodies are buried. That's part of the deal here. And Trump is a symptom. We're not really talking about presidential candidates here, but Trump is a symptom because what's going on? He's a symbol of the revolt. A lot of people, you say Trump isn't conservative, they go, "I don't care, he's giving the GOP establishment a headache."
Yeah, and I'll say that I'm enjoying the sideshow as it's happening, because that's true. The establishment is sitting there, and some of their dirty laundry is getting aired, and some of their false flags that they like to fly are being shredded with that candidate.
Exactly. Exactly, and that's what's going on. But I'll be quite honest. One of the things, and I know we talked about this at lunch, one of the things I see in this whole postponement of the votes for the whip and the majority leader, what I see is that they know they've got a major problem. I think they're pretty sure that McCarthy isn't going to get elected. And you and I talked about this. It doesn't matter if nobody gets elected to the speakership. McCarthy will get the job anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As an interim?
Yes.
Because he's number two in line. So it doesn't matter if the caucus elects him or not. They just appoint him the interim.
Well, and really they can't do that because there has to be a vote of the full House.
Right.
So you have to get 124 votes inside the caucus to get a majority to be Speaker, and he doesn't have the votes. But you, in the end of October, the full House votes on the new Speaker, and so you have to get 218 of the 435
right, exactly.
in order to get there. Now, supposedly, if you come out of the caucus election, and Chaffetz has already said this publicly, that if he doesn't get it and whoever gets picked in, inside the caucus election, he'll support when it comes to the floor. And with 220 plus members, it shouldn't have to be, they shouldn't have to lean to the Democrats for anything to get a majority, unless of course a conservative comes out of the caucus elections, because then you're going to see defections of guys like Peter King,
yeah,
and others who will vote against that person as Speaker. Now, Chuck, that doesn't necessarily make Kevin McCarthy the presumptive interim Speaker. What it could do is throw open the floor for Nancy Pelosi to come
back. It could.
It could throw open the floor for, you name the individual, to come back. Now, we've heard all these arguments from a lot of outside sources that you don't have to be a member to be voted the Speaker of the House.
Oh, my gosh. I've gotten into these things online with
people. Yes. Well, let me just stop them right there. It would be the first time in recorded history, in the 228-year history of our constitutional government, that someone would be picked to be the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives who wasn't already a voted, elected member of Congress.
Okay, even a member of Congress, if you use Congress in its large sense, which includes the Senate.
Yes, exactly.
Not just the House of Representatives. I actually had an online discussion with a guy who insisted that Ted Cruz needs to withdraw from the presidential race and run for Speaker of the House. And I said, you're aware that he's a member of the Senate.
Right.
Yes, I know, but anyone can be Speaker of the House. And I said, yes, I'm aware of that. But there are so many problems involved in this. In fact, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but the members of the Senate are not allowed to be on the floor of the House of Representatives except by special invitation and vice versa.
Exactly. Well, and the other point is too, Chuck, I would challenge that anybody can be elected Speaker of the House, because the House sets its own rules. And I would gather somewhere in the House rules it says that in order to be
a sitting member,
to be eligible for election to a leadership position, you already have to be a member of the body.
Now, can you be a member of the opposition, of the minority party, and be a Speaker of the House?
Absolutely.
The answer is yes, because it's happened.
It has happened before.
Daniel Webster was a member of the current one.
No, the historical 1800s.
The 19th century Daniel Webster, the famous one, the orator who was a brilliant guy, was Speaker of the House while he was a member of the minority party.
Right.
So
that has happened.
Yeah.
And it could happen again. But that other fanciful thing is just absolutely out of the question.
Oh, and what was the other one I heard? Newt Gingrich. Let's bring back Newt as Speaker of the House. And I'm like,
For the love of all that's holy, why?
Yeah, let's jump off a bridge first.
Yeah, well, I would jump with you, because that's, I don't think that's even remotely possible.
Some of these things are just so unbearably silly.
Yeah.
One thing you got to remember too, Jason Chaffetz is not particularly popular right now he may be a member of the Freedom Caucus, but he's not popular there, and I'll tell you why.
Well, I'm going to double check that as we're talking here and find out if he is.
Because Jason Chaffetz, if you recall, Mark Meadows from North Carolina is the guy who really got the push on to do this no confidence vote in the House. And I think the original one put out was tabled, but Meadows brought it back up because Mark Meadows was a member of a subcommittee, and he voted against which bill was it now? It's gone out of my mind. But he voted against the bill that everybody was being whipped into to support, and he was the subcommittee chair. Well, Jason Chaffetz, who was a member of Boehner's leadership team, removed him from that post, and he went back to the Freedom Caucus, and essentially, I don't know what they did. They took him out back behind the House of Representatives and beat him up, or basically they excoriated him.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing he did was go back, and 2 days later, I think, he reinstated Meadows.
Okay, I take that back. You are correct. I was getting Chaffetz and Justin Amash from Michigan confused.
Okay.
Amash was a founding member of the Freedom Caucus. Okay. Chaffetz is not a member. I apologize for that. I am glad that we started talking about this again so that I didn't sit out there with a with something completely fanciful setting out there. And I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. I have been corrected, and I accept that correction happily. Chaffetz paints himself as a conservative.
Exactly.
But he, again, he has a foot in both camps. Now, that I did get correct. But,
well, I always call those guys splinter seats.
Yes.
Because they sit on the fence.
Yep.
They straddle the fence, which means they get splitters in their backside.
That's exactly right. Now, Mark Meadows is a member of the one of the founding members of the Freedom
Exactly.
Caucus. So these guys are and they've got a group of about 50 who they consider members of their caucus.
I'm glad you brought that up, because what have we always said needs to happen? How many members do you have to have in your back pocket in order to make a major impact in Congress?
Well, the number you and I have always said is 45.
Yeah. I always thought around 50.
Yeah, around, well, we've been saying 45. So 45 to 50. And you know what? When it gets right down to it, in order to really set the agenda, they only really need about 20 more. Because if you've got 70 out of a class of 215,
yeah,
you've got a third.
Well, what's the current House membership of Republicans right now? Like 230 or something?
Yeah, it's
I don't know the exact numbers.
Let me double check the number.
It's around that, 232 or somewhere in that vicinity. You start figuring 70 members out of 232, you've got a major mm-hmm. block that you got to deal with. You will not push through any legislation at all that riles them up if they're really riled up.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Well, that's happening now with 50.
And as long as they stay together, and that's the key. If they all agree to back each other's plays and support each other's votes, then as a speaker or leader of the caucus or of the body, you have only two options. You either work with them or you go to the opposing yeah. party to get votes.
One of the problems you run into with groups like
and
this
that is... And that was part of Boehner's reason why he had to step down.
Exactly. One of the things you have to watch for in a group like this, there's always somebody who wants to move in and co-opt you. They want to declare themselves a member of your caucus, and they want to come in, and then little by little by little by little, it starts out small, little by little, they corrupt you. Mm-hmm. Well, so you need to support me on this, so I'll support you on that. And you find yourself getting little tidbits, and they're getting major things through. Barry, this is the strategy they've used. One of the reasons that the Tea Party has lost some steam is because it got co-opted by mainstream Republicans
okay.
who joined up, basically attempted to steer the group. Now, some of the Tea Party group said, oh, no, you don't.
Exactly.
Locally. There were some efforts here in the Westerville Tea Party for our local rep to sort of co-opt the Westerville Tea Party for her particular use
mm-hmm.
in my state rep.
Yes.
Not national. It has not worked out well for her.
No, it hasn't.
Because we have a strong Tea Party group, but...
By the way, it's 247 in the Republican
247. Oh gosh, it's higher than I thought it was.
That's right. They've got a
oh they
caucus.
Picked up some. They picked up votes in 14.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
They picked up
yes,
seats.
Yes.
That's why
I
I'm
just
off.
Couldn't remember the number off the top of my head. So
yeah.
Anyhow, so what we're getting down to is well, regardless of what happens, Chuck. Right now, even if McCarthy loses the speakership election, he's still the majority leader. Because that's the number two spot behind the speaker.
Right.
And then you have the whip. And right now, that's Steve Scalise, who's from Louisiana. He would keep his job. But now what we're going to do is we're going to vote for a new speaker. And then at the end of the month, that gives that new speaker 3 weeks to decide whether or not he wants to keep the same people in as his coalition or not.
Yeah.
Or if he wants to ask for open seats for those other two positions. And there are other people who are... lining themselves up to run. As a matter of fact, I think there are actually three candidates for each of the majority leader and the whip spots in the House of Representatives. So, and in the majority caucus, excuse me, because there is a leader and a whip over on the Democratic side of the aisle too, but they really don't matter that much in this particular.
What they do is they matter when it's a close vote and there are defectors on the Republican side. Sometimes you need the whip to get in there. Remember that there are still districts, for instance, in the South that are Democratic, mm-hmm. although that's coming to an end rather quickly, that are Democratic by default, and there are conservatives sitting in those seats, conservative Democrats. Texas has some of those. Those are rapidly coming to an end. A lot of the former, genetic Democrat seats have gone Republican.
Exactly.
Because essentially they couldn't get anything done in the House. So the Democratic Party basically stuck them in a corner.
Well, of course.
And didn't let them play.
Well, of course.
Well, what does that do? That tends to make constituents really mad.
Yeah, it does.
I said, okay, you want to play it that way? Okay, we'll play it that way. That's the problem with these establishment types. They want to dictate to you. And if you won't take dictation, then what they'll do is they'll maneuver you into doing that which you don't want to do. And when that doesn't work, then they basically come out and say, you will do it or else. Well, how does you will do it or else work? It doesn't.
You give somebody that kind of an ultimatum, usually they're going to take the or else, especially if they don't think you've got the wherewithal to back it up.
Exactly.
Now, if you do have the wherewithal to back it up, well, guess what? I mean, you're basically creating animosity that will come back and bite you sooner or later.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly...
Ask a parent who's ever done that to a child repeated times until the child got big enough to give it back.
Well, okay, do not provoke your children to wrath.
That's right.
And that's, constantly forcing unfair circumstances on a child provokes them to wrath. And that's exactly what these guys have been getting away with. Get behind us, send us money. As soon as we have a majority, you're going to get this and this and this and this. And then you get your majority and they start surrendering to the opposition party over and over. Immigration, health care. John Boehner basically got elected Speaker of the House so he could defund health care and deconstruct it. Now, anybody who knew anything about John Boehner going in, and I knew this early in the 2000s, John Boehner was all about getting his personal health care plan passed.
Yep, absolutely.
That's why you keep hearing this mantra from the GOP establishment, repeal and replace Obamacare. And I have had confrontations with people and said, what is this fetish with replacement? We have to have a plan in place. I go, no, we don't. What we need to do is completely get the federal government out of health care. Mm-hmm. I said, you want costs back under control? Get the feds out. We've had out-of-control health care cost increases since 1965 with Medicare because that's what caused it. You began to restrict doctors. When I was a kid, Barry, mm-hmm. and you may be a little past this age, when I was a kid,
I'm a little past being a kid. Yes.
Well, no, past the age that I am.
You were.
Where I grew up, uh-huh. you could get a doctor to come to the house and do a house call.
Yeah, well, when I was very little, my pediatrician would come to the house, yeah.
And when does that happen now?
It doesn't.
Never.
It doesn't, unless you have some home health service that you paid for, but that's not normally your regular practice.
And that's doctor. One of the quote-unquote Cadillac plans.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That Obama and the Democrats, except for instance, Hillary, are interested, if you've got a Cadillac plan, they want to tax it. And what that means is, you're paying too much. You are increasing healthcare costs by having this Cadillac plan that pays for all these fancy things. In other words, what they're saying is you can remain alive past your expiration date.
Mm-hmm.
What they say they want the expiration date to be. This is why we have problems in healthcare.
Yes.
And guys like Boehner were all about building this quote-unquote skeleton plan. Well, what happens, yeah. Barry, when you build, or I think I've heard you refer to it as a Christmas tree plan.
Christmas tree plan, that's
what,
right.
What do you do with a Christmas tree? You hang lights and
tinsel and ornaments and all kinds of pretty things. And you do, and you know, if you're like most families, it isn't like a little bit here and a little bit there. You hang as much on it as it'll possibly bear.
Oh, absolutely, without falling over and killing the cat.
Or burning up. You know, one of the two, depending if you use live trees or fake trees.
And, you know, it reminds me of the old days when they used to light Christmas trees with candles, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what a bad idea.
Actually, I think it's kind of pretty. But
it's pretty, and it's pretty dangerous, yeah.
Well, that's the reason why you use the electric candles.
Exactly.
Now, and, you know, you do the
fake flames. But John Boehner had a Christmas tree plan in mind along.
Absolutely.
So instead of getting Obamacare right up front, we would have had it in 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's the difference? Well, we got 10 more years to hold on to some of our money until it got so expensive. And now, as we see, it's getting so expensive, we can't afford to run the thing. Big mm-hmm. shock. So this is the problem. People are... calling John Boehner a conservative at any point was simply a matter of labels.
Well, and funny thing about labels, you know, I can put any label on anything I want to, but that doesn't make it that. I mean, I could set an apple on the table and yeah. put a label on it that says watermelon. Does that make it a watermelon?
Well, that's the old story about, okay, if I point to a dog and say, how many, you know, my dog Sam downstairs,
yeah.
how many legs does he have?
Four, I'm assuming.
No, he has five because that thing that hangs off his back
is
in between, it's a tail.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, normally people would say, no, that's his tail. Oh, no, there is no such thing as a tail. That's a leg. It doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
You can talk to me about that being a tail all you want. I reject the idea that there's a tail. That's a leg.
Now, see, now you're starting to sound like an existentialist and a postmodernist.
And that's exactly what we're dealing with.
Exactly.
That's why when you hear the term, I'm a conservative.
Run for the hills.
That's right. Because that term has no meaning
It has
anymore.
No fixed meaning anymore.
Yeah.
Because we have compassionate conservatives and common sense conservatives and pragmatic conservatives. And, you know, and the worst, the conservative conservatives.
Name an adjective.
You name it. But the point is when you get the political literature that pops up in your mailbox all the time or on your website or your email, watch out for the words pragmatic, compassionate, and common sense as descriptors for the word conservative. Because what it really means is I don't like the traditional fixed definition of the word conservative. And I got to be me, and so whatever I do, I'm labeling as conservative, and so should you. I should write a song. That rhymes.
Go
maybe,
for it.
Maybe we should do some jib-jab stuff on here then. So, no, but again, okay, but I want to segue right now, because since we're talking about faux conservatism, immediately my thoughts run to John Kasich.
Well, that's because we're in Ohio, and you can't avoid it because, boy, talk about a faux conservative. Wow.
Indeed. Okay. I want to start with the humorous side of this and then go to the serious side. The humorous side of this is, and I don't know if we've got this queued up or not that we could actually play it, but it just hit today, as a matter of fact, as we were taping this, this pops up on our feed. That from the corner, which is the nationalreview.com online, it's called their corner, where they have like little snippets of things going on in the political world, headlined, John Kasich offers to buy Bibles for critics of his Medicaid expansion plan. Do we have that piece of tape?
We have it. I have it queued up right here.
Let's run that. I want people to hear John Kasich about giving Bibles to critics of Medicaid expansion.
You know, the part of the difficulty we have in this town is we don't have leaders who are willing to lead instead of reacting to who yells the loudest.
Or worse yet, feeding on fear.
Well, look at Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know how many people are yelling at me? I go on to events where people yell at me. You know what? You know what I tell them? I mean, God bless him. I'm telling him a little bit better at this. I said, you know, there's a book. It's got a new part and an old part. They put it together. It's a remarkable book. If you don't have one, I'll buy you one. And it talks about how we treat the poor. I mean, sometimes you just have to lead.
Okay. I'll agree with him on two things in this statement, Chuck. Number one, we do have a lack of leadership in this town being Columbus. The key person who has abandoned leadership in this town is John Kasich. Secondly, I'll agree with him that you can really find out how to care for the poor and the needy by getting into and reading and living the Bible. But there's nowhere in the Bible that says expand a government takeaway program, which takes away from people who can produce and provide, to basically entrap those who are in difficult circumstances. It talks about the family, and it talks about the church helping the poor and the destitute. Nowhere in that Bible, either the old part or the new part, as he says, does it ever say the government should provide. There's only one place where the government ever did provide, and that was with Joseph in Egypt, as he took from the people an ever-increasing amount during the years of plenty to provide for the years of famine.
And at which case, at the end, Pharaoh ended up owning all the property, all the animals, and all the people.
Right.
Because they sold themselves into servitude.
And that was not a – and we can look at that as a blessing to the people in one sense, that they survived 7 years of famine. But really what it was is it was a lesson from God sending them into captivity because of their turning away from him.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look through the whole idea of Isaac and all of the children and Reuben and Gad and everybody else – and all of the things that they did that really were, shall we say, ungodly, it's amazing that God did allow that provision to keep them from starving to death during those 7 years.
Yeah, exactly.
But really, it was set up in such a way that they, as the bloodline of ancient Israel, were repaid for how they treated Joseph. They sold him into slavery to the Egyptians. They ended up being in slavery to the Egyptians. God has a way of balancing scales. However, God didn't say use government to care for the poor.
Nowhere. In fact,
nowhere.
He did say, thou shalt not steal.
And if a man will not work, then shall he not eat. And if a man does not care for his own and therefore those in his own household,
you can play the game of
he's denied the faith and is worse than an infidel.
Of quoting Ananias and Sapphira from the book of Acts. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, if you look at that, the problem was not the fact that they had voluntarily sold property to support the group. The problem was that they had sold property, kept some back for themselves, but lied and said they'd given it all in to glorify themselves.
Exactly.
That's the real issue. By the way, do you know off the top of your head where these comments were made by John Kasich?
It sounded to me like it was an interview, probably on Face the Nation or one
of those. Oh, no. This was like a town hall meeting.
It was a town hall. Okay.
United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Ah, okay.
He was playing to the immigrant crowd.
Exactly. Oh, and by the way, John Kasich's also a big proponent of legalizing illegal immigrants.
Yes.
He stated that a number of times, too. You see, but Chuck, it was those comments and others at that Hispanic Chamber of Commerce event that has now cost Kasich his meteoric rise in the New Hampshire polls. Because as of today, as we were taping this, I got a feed from my regular news sources saying that today, John Kasich is now sitting in seventh place in New Hampshire. Seventh place. Why? Part of it was that backfired. His hat tip Medicaid expansion backfired in New Hampshire. Now, the other big problem is, And this is coming also. Now, this was last month. He's been in New Hampshire pretty much ever since he announced his presidential run, except for the time he had to come to Ohio for that debate and go out to California for that debate. He's basically lived in New Hampshire. And basically, he got accosted. He was in a parade or in some kind of a community event, and he had a parent who came up to him and said, "Hey, you know what? You get an F on the report card from American Principles in Action, which is a special interest group. They rated all the presidential candidates on their Common Core education positions. John Kasich gets an F for the state of Ohio. An F because, as you know, he is one of the largest proponents on that stage. If you don't count Jeb Bush's flip-flopping, you don't count Mike Huckabee's, I was for it before I was against it. He is the biggest supporter, tripling down in many cases, on expanding the role of the federal government in education through Common Core. Now, basically, this data, it says here, and this comes from the APA in their analysis. It says, Kasich's record in Ohio shows that as governor, he has done more to violate the privacy of students than to protect it. This is what this parent was calling him out on in New Hampshire, in public. And it says, Kasich's budget of 2014-2015 created a $250 million fund to provide grants to various educational groups for the development of innovative educational programs. Unfortunately, the 350 school districts currently participating in the program are required to share extensive amounts of personally identifiable data on the students and their parents without their knowledge or consent. And this was a Kasich push. And then basically, as he was confronted, Kasich responded this way, quote, I don't know what you're talking about to tell you the truth, unquote. Well, that's no surprise. It seems like he really isn't paying much attention to anything when it comes to education, as Richard Ross, his handpicked superintendent of public instruction, is basically under fire right now for the data rigging that was going on in the Department of Education to protect certain charter schools. Funny thing is, Chuck, the individual at the Department of Education, whose position was specifically created by Kasich himself, a gentleman by the name of David Hansen, who, after this blew up here about a month and a half ago, stepped down and quit, just happens to be the husband of John Kasich's campaign manager and Ohio chief of staff, Beth Hansen.
Well,
so what does Kasich do? Again, just like with the Common Core standards directly, he doubles himself down on this. Quote, he says, let me tell you about my record in Ohio in education. We have the largest amount of funding for K-12 education in Ohio history. Right there is enough to make me want to stop him right there. It's like, yeah, we're just going to dump more money into the beast. And then he talks about these whole charter school thing, and it's hilarious. And he finishes this quote up, and this is the quote that's in Breitbart.com on this issue, so I want to source it. And he says, quote, I don't want the government having their hands on our stuff. And if they get their hands on our stuff, I want a judge to approve it. Okay, there is so much wrong with that comment.
Well, especially when you go back to the United States Hispanic Chamber of Commerce thing, where he basically just said, government has the right to take your stuff and give it to somebody else.
Yeah, so again, it's like, which version of John Kasich do you hear? It depends on the crowd that he's speaking to. And again, this is a situation that we've known this in Ohio for a while, but now the people of New Hampshire are really starting to get a better look at who John Kasich really is. And it's not a look from the millions of dollars in TV campaign ads that he spent in New Hampshire alone.
Millions.
Millions, at least $2 million to record now, and projection that he was going to spend $4 million. He was quoted last weekend as saying, you know, that New Hampshire, they're betting it all on New Hampshire, and if he doesn't show strong there, then he's not going forward. Now, that's funny, Chuck, because I also have seen reports where he's actually starting to build campaign staff in Iowa, one of the other early states, the caucus states. So which is it, John? Are you putting everything into New Hampshire, and if you don't fare well there in their primary, you're out of the race? Or is it, as long as I actually get a vote in New Hampshire, I'm going to keep moving on? Remember, 2 weeks ago, Chuck, John Kasich was polling at number two in New Hampshire. He was, in every poll you could take, he was in the top tier for New Hampshire voters. But ever since, from this Hispanic Chamber of Commerce to the Common Core issue to now, and we don't have time to talk about it, so we're going to talk about this on the next program, his green energy mandates for Ohio, which I see as a direct pandering to New Hampshire voters. John Kasich is showing the voters in New Hampshire that he's really not ready for the prime time of presidential politics.
Well, You now know what we think, and we want to know what you think. Come out to www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And feel free to send us an email, comment on this podcast when it's finally up. We'd love to know what you think. So come on out there. And again, we'll be here next week. So join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.